Where's my piece of electronics? Okay, it's coming. I wanted to anyway spend 30 seconds or so to give you a bit of an update on Switzerland, because I know a lot of you prayed for that. So the conference that we ran in February went very, very well. We had tremendous input from, the top economists in the world, and we were able to present what it is that we're trying to say in a way that was credible. That was really the whole point. Thank you. Thanks. The referendum then was on June the 10th, and we only got 25% of the vote, which is a very, very low percentage. It was interesting is I just got the results within the last week. I mean, it could have been Monday of, I don't know when. I mean, Monday isn't Labor Day in Europe. And so I got an email in the last few days that showed that 80%, this is a completely secular research institution in Switzerland that had nothing to do with whatsoever. They did a survey on our material, and 80% of the population is in favor of what we stand for. So I was in Holland recently speaking at a conference, and people always ask me, "So what are you doing now?" And so I said, "I know a number of you asking what am I doing now?" And so I said, "No, I'm working on Project June 11," and I just stopped. I never said anything. Just stopped. They're looking at everybody. And I figured, "Wake up." Wake up. And finally said, "Okay, Korch, what are you doing? What is this?" And I said, "Well, the referendum was on June the 10th. I'm working on Project June 11 because we haven't stopped, you know." So anyway, I just wanted to let you know that. Pray for that. For those of you who are not aware, and then I better get going here because I don't have a lot of time. Switzerland is unique because they have a system of mandatory referenda that are binding. The two are not the same thing. So under certain conditions, there must be a referendum. We fulfill those conditions. And if you win, then that referendum is binding. So our was to change the constitution of the country. That's pretty heady stuff, okay? And we're going to keep on going. Thank you. That's the topic that was given to me, the politics of global economics. Let's see where in the world we can go here with that. There we go. I want to deal with only three things, only. Kingdom, politics, and global economics. No problem. We can solve everything in half an hour. I mean, there we go. What I've done is cherry-picked just a few items, and probably none of us will identify with every one of those items. That's not my point. My point is for you to know what God is calling you to, okay? So I'm saying, here's an item. Can you identify with this? Here's an item. So that's what this is going to be all about, okay? Let's start with the kingdom. It's a good place to start. There are two aspects of Christ's teaching. Okay, one is personal and one is corporate. And the personal are basically the Beatitudes. Okay, now what's interesting is if you look at them, they're all in the future tense. Blessed are they, for they shall. Blessed for they shall, they shall, they shall. It's all in the future. Okay, there's one exception, and only one exception, which is those who are poor in spirit, because theirs today is the kingdom. Okay. Now, if you want to deal in the levels of what we're talking about here, global economics, or whatever it is that God is calling you to, with that humility, you can today, without poverty of spirit, see the kingdom already. Okay, and if you don't have that, you're not going to see it. You're not part of that. Okay, the corporate is the kingdom. The personal are the Beatitudes. And that fusion of those two comes through the poor in spirit. Okay? So whatever it is that as statesmen that we're trying to do, that we're trying to change. That aspect has to be in you personally, and then that downside up. Notice I didn't call it the upside down kingdom. I figured, let's just really hit this home. It's the downside up kingdom. It's all ridiculous, but it's wonderfully ridiculous. All right? All right. Within that dual mandate, what are we called to be? Oh, my goodness. Love without courage and wisdom is sentimentality as with the ordinary church member. Maybe we all need to get on our knees and say, God, help me. Love without courage and wisdom is sentimentality. And that is so often who we are. Okay, well, it doesn't end there. How about courage without love and wisdom is foolishness, as with the ordinary soldier. All right, well, let's keep on going. How about wisdom without love and courage? That's cowardice, as with the ordinary intellectual. All right, well, how about the one who has love, courage, and wisdom is one in a million who moves the world? And no, that's not original. I didn't come up with that. Okay, let's deal with politics. So remember, I'm trying to put all these three things together. Okay, kingdom, politics. I'm going quickly because we're going to deal primarily with economics, which is really what this is supposed to be all about. Politics are activities of running a government, of running a city, of whatever, okay? But it's ultimately about power. I've never been a politician, but I'm about to judge politicians. Most politicians are in it for the power. There are people who are there truly to serve. However, the ultimate, the issue really is power. We have three primary drives: money, sex, and power, okay? Of those, only power is infinite or is unlimited. Let me explain to you why. The sex part, I think, is fairly obvious. It's definitely limited, okay? But the money part, we think the money part is not limited. It is. For the simple reason, once you're worth $50 million, okay, or I'm just arbitrarily picking a number, for you to make another $50 million is irrelevant from the perspective of your ability to spend that money. You can't spend the money. So why, if you already are worth $50 million or $100 million or $1 billion, you know, why does Trump insist on making more money? It's not for the money. He can't spend it anyway. It's power. This is a power game, okay? So, we say follow the money in crime, in, you know, those kind of issues, okay? And that is true for I'm sure, for every one of us here. That is true of the 320 million, roughly, that live in the United States. That is true for 319.99 million, okay? There's that very small group of people who are truly at the global elite. And for them, it's follow the power. So there are ridiculous decisions that are made. And you wonder sometimes, why in the world do people do that? Let me give you an example that's in the news right now. So Trump has sex with a woman and then pays her $130,000 so that she doesn't talk about it. For her, it's follow the money. Wow, that was the best 5 minutes of my life. I just made $130,000. Pardon me for being so crass. For him, it's power. Because he didn't want her to talk because he wanted the power from an electoral perspective. You've got to differentiate these two. And I think this... You've got to walk away. When you try to analyze the news, think of it this way, okay? We are so used to follow the money. No, I'm saying follow the power, okay? That's that level that we're trying to reach. Who are the people who really make the decisions? I just had a meeting with the Minister of Finance of Greece, Yaros Varoufakis, and you look at what the European Central Bank and the International Monetary Fund did to the country and did to that man personally makes absolutely no sense. They lost a ton of money. All of the taxpayers in Europe, other than the Greeks, lost an enormous amount of money. What was it all about? Okay, they lost billions. What it was all about is, we're going to get you. And they said that. We are going to make you an example. So when it's time for Portugal or Italy or some other country, we're going to say, you know what we did to Greece? Tell you what, you walk down that path, we're going to do the same thing to you. It's a power game. Okay? So when you analyze the news, when you try to understand what's going on, think of it through that paradigm rather than a money paradigm. The money paradigm works 99.99% of the time at the level that we normally live at. It does not work at that level. Okay? All right, politics. So here's one thing. This is... what's going on? Somehow the world has not changed. Oh, there we go. Thank you. So we live today in an age of populism, okay? This is not, as Dennis said yesterday, this is not an American phenomenon. This is a global phenomenon, okay? You look in Germany, the AfD, the Alternative für Deutschland. You look at the five-star movement in Italy. So we now have a government run in Italy run by a comedian. And a really crazy comedian, okay? And, you know, on and on and on and on, right? And we have Trump who is in power here. What in the world is populism? Populism is difficult to define. It's kind of like culture. It's a very difficult word. It basically has to do with the populace, with people, but it's trying to come up with simplistic solutions to very complicated issues. And again, that's sort of simplifying that, okay? By the way, last year, it was the dictionary word of the year. Very interesting what's happened globally. Why is this going on? Here's some reasons. So here's a graph. I think a lot in graphs, and so be with me here while I show you a ton of graphs. So the simple reason, I think a picture is worth 1,000 words. So I know it's just working. Oh, there we go. There we go. Thank you. What this is the share of income, okay, coming out of corporate profits, going towards labor. And you notice it's going down, but it's fairly steady from 1947 to 1980, 1990, not too bad, and we've got the sudden crash. So the amount of money that is going to labor versus corporate profits is suddenly crashing, okay? Maybe that says something. Let's keep on going. All right. This is the average income of labor in the United States. I'm using a lot of American figures here, but trust me, they're the same pretty well the world over. So when you hear my salary has gone up by almost 10 times, from $2.50 an hour in 1964, I remember working for $1.87 or something, and it's now the average is 22.65. Let's call it 10 times. The what we call nominal salary. The word nominal means it's a number, but it's not real. The top is the real, okay? This is in economics. This is what we call real. This is what we call nominal, because the nominal does not include inflation, does not include external effects that essentially means what it's going on. You notice labor has not made any money whatsoever. It's absolutely identical. So the politicians will tell you, yeah, but you're doing really wonderful. Come on, you're making 10 times the amount of money that you made in 1964. But in your gut, in your heart, it goes, yeah, I don't know about that. Yeah, I don't feel right. This is, think of politics and economics. We're merging these two. I'm about to show you something else in just a minute. These two charts that I just showed you is what create this chart. All right, so here we're talking the Great Depression here, roughly, okay? And this red line is the amount of money, the net worth, I'm sorry, of the bottom 90% of the population. So you notice it was terrible during the Great Depression, and then it kept on going up, and then look at down here, it's crashing. Okay, now, this green line, this is the wealth, net wealth of the top, not 1%, but 0.1%. And you notice during they owned a heck of a lot more, and then we ended up with a Great Depression. And guess what? We're coming up to the same point again. Now, look it. Over here, we had populism. This is FDR, etc. Massive redistributionism, all sorts of socialistic policies that the government put into place, and here we are again. Why is it that we see the politics that we see? Well, there we go. I started slowly with the two previous charts, but this one by itself shows you in one chart as to what in the world's going on. People are angry, and they have a reason to be angry. This isn't just because, you know, the average human being, let's just keep it to the U.S. here just for a minute, but it's the same the world over. They can't explain this to you. They're just angry because this thing is not working. You guys are, screwing us. That's a highly technical economic word.
That's deep.
Really deep, exactly. All right, that's politics for you. Now, at the end of every one of these sections I'm going to show you, I'm going to ask you this question. So we have four focus groups, okay? And what is the response? Some of the focus groups will respond more easily to some of the points I give you. Some of them more inexactly. What is your point in all of that? Obviously, from a political perspective, the prayer aspect is easy to understand. Okay, from the community action councils, you understand some of that. Okay, I get. So what is it I do about it? From a policy perspective, I don't think you're going to do much about this. Okay, this is not something that is easy from a, I'll go later on as to things that I'm doing that are involved in this. But most of this, from the policy perspective, we cannot really respond to the economic drivers that are polarizing us politically. Okay, but you can in different parts. Certainly education, you can explain to people, let me explain to you what the news actually means. Okay, so there's a four different perspectives that we run here in the Statesman, and we need to be aware of all this. All right, let's look at economics. What do you think are our four greatest challenges today, economically, globally? I'm going to give you 5 seconds. Think about it. What do you think they are? Okay, how many of you think you got one? Put up your hand. Yeah, I heard really good words here, so I agree with that. How many of you got two?
Equity.
All right, well, we're going to stop at that point. Am I right? Am I wrong? Here's the four that I picked. There we go. A lot of you said debt, so thank you. So I picked debt, jobs, demographics, and this last one, Thucydides trap. What in the world is that? Well, we're going to get there. All right, let's talk about debt. The government follows its own accounting rules. How in the world does that work? I'm going to give you a very, very simple picture that I know some of you heard me before. I've walked through this before. So let's say you're buying a house, and you borrow $300,000 for the house, and you put extra money in, obviously, and you have a mortgage. And you, let's say your monthly, I'm just using nice round numbers. Let's say your monthly payments are $4,000 a month, PITI, you know, principal, interest, taxes, and insurance. And the first month you make your $4,000 payment, and the second month, you know, your wife, who you really, really love, pardon me, wives, your husband, you know, whatever, says, you know, we really need the kitchen upgraded. And so you spend a whole bunch of money on the kitchen, and you don't have the $4,000, but, you know, interest rates on credit cards are so low, they're actually lower than the mortgage rates right now. And so what I'm going to do is of the $4,000 I need to pay, I have $2,000 still left after all the kitchen work. I'm going to borrow $2,000 on my credit card, but I make my mortgage payment. And the story keeps on going. And at the end of the year, you've put in new carpets and you've bought new furniture and all sorts of things, but you've made every mortgage payment. And so how much do you owe? Let's say you put $10,000 on your credit card. Over that period of time, over that year. Okay, so how much do you owe? Well, on a 30-year mortgage, the principal payments after a year are essentially zero. Let's say $300. Doesn't really matter. Let's call it zero. Okay. So you and I, we would all say we owe $300,000 on our mortgage, correct? And we now owe $10,000 on our credit cards, right? So we owe in aggregate together, we owe $310,000. Of course, that's what the government does too. No, they don't. They don't do anywhere close to that. What does the government do? If the government were to buy the house and borrow $300,000 and then put $10,000 on a credit card, at the end of the year, legally, the government would owe, I'm glad you're sitting down, the government only owes $10,000. And you go, what? Because the government only owes what it puts on its credit card. And you say, government doesn't have a credit card. Oh, yes, it does. They're called treasuries. The government only owes what it issues in treasuries. It doesn't owe what it owes in contracts, because they're not due this year. See, we only owe what's due this year. We don't owe what's due next year. We don't. We wouldn't want to really let any people know what we actually owe. So the question is, what does the government actually owe? It's called the fiscal gap. You heard Dennis talk about it earlier, and it's about $210 trillion. Forget about the $22 trillion that they tell you that we owe. We owe $210 trillion. By the way, and I know some of you have heard me before, I'm just very briefly going to explain to you what in the world $1 trillion is. I know it's one with a whole lot of zeros. It doesn't mean anything to any of us. I think you can get this. Most of us can get a handle on $1 million. I know it's a lot of money, but most of us, okay, I've sort of got that. I know what, it's a nice house there, so whatever, okay, I got that. If you were to spend $1 million every single day of the year, every single day, in what year would you have had to start in order to have spent $1 trillion by today? You can get your calculator out, I'll help you. It's 500 years before Christ. And that's one. That's one. And we owe 210. Yeah, of course we're going to pay all this off. Of course we will. Like, never. All right, where are we at? I've got all these wonderful charts here. These will really make you happy. So this is debt as a percentage of GDP. Now, most of what I will show you here is a percentage of GDP, gross domestic product. Okay, and that's how to compare things. So if I'm going to compare the strength of a 5-year-old to a 25-year-old, I have to have some way of comparing their innate abilities, correct? Otherwise, it's totally unfair. Of course, a 25-year-old will win on, they run faster, they lift more, etc. So in order to create an equal method of properly comparing things, we use percentage of GDP. Okay, and that the 5-year-old and the 25-year-old are now both at the same level because I compare them to their innate abilities. And that's exactly what this does. So in the Great Depression, we had this much debt, and then we had the crash. We now have, doesn't look very good. Doesn't look very good. This is corporate debt, same thing, percentage of GDP, exactly the same thing. Can you see the bars on there? No. There are bars. I'm sorry, they're not very, very visible here. Every single time the debt level comes up, can you barely see this bar? Okay, that's a recession. Every single time that happens, okay? Now, again, this is a percentage of GDP. We are now comparing apples to apples, not apples to giraffes. And we keep on getting worse, and the crashes keep on getting worse. Look at where we're now. We have never, ever been this high in history that we have here with hard data. Not very good. And here's the same thing globally. So that was an American figure. This is a gross debt, so this is corporate, governmental, and private. Gross global, again, as a percentage of GDP. So again, we are using the correct methods of comparison between the various years, and this is simply, we've taken U.S. and China out. You know, they're the behemoths in the market, so let's see what, even without them, you see how bad it is. By the way, one of the big differences between today versus the crash of 2007-2008 is, In many ways, I know the actions of the Fed and all this kind of stuff, but in many ways, it was the emerging markets that saved us during that time because they did not have the debt levels from a percentage of GDP perspective that we had. We were way out of whack. Well, now everybody's way out of whack. Okay. By the way, the Fed issued $19 trillion worth of lines. Total American debt wasn't even at that level during those years, and the Fed issued $19 trillion. And I have on my computer, I have a chart of every single day during that period of time of what was issued to which country, to which central bank, etc. $19 trillion. Unbelievable. I've never, ever seen that published. I've never seen that come out in any magazine or newspaper or the Wall Street Journal or anywhere else. And the next one. Thank you. this is just, again, just to show you the percentage of GDP kind of a thing. Here is GDP and here is debt, okay? So you can understand when we use the percentage of GDP, why that is the real way of looking at it. Because when you look at actual numbers, they don't tend to mean a whole lot until you see a chart like this, right? That's why in those kind, you should always look at what are you representing? Hard numbers, what we call nominal, or percentage of GDP? That's really what you need to look at, okay? And this one, let's just, I don't think I have enough time. So next, let's look at jobs. What I want to do is differentiate jobs versus work. Work is what, somehow we're not hooked up here. I don't know what's happening. Can you go on to the next slide? Thank you. Jobs is what we do to earn money, and this isn't necessarily the way these words are always defined. I'm just going to use it like this. I'm trying to differentiate a point here, okay? And at work is what we do to accomplish something. It's our calling. It's what we call, what we believe Christ is calling us to. It's how we take care of our children or our spouse or whatever. That's work. A job is something I do in order to make money, okay? And jobs, by the way, it's basically a post-industrial revolution kind of a concept, because before that, people just did work all the time, and it's what we call subsistence living. They did what they had to do in order to live. Today, we have this outside kind of a thing called a job, okay? What we need to do is we need to turn work into jobs, and by the way, Doug, that's the whole community currency aspect, etc. That's his vision as to how to do that from a local perspective. All right, let's keep on going here. The issue with jobs is, I'm not a Luddite, if you know Mr. Ludd, that's where that word comes from, so who went around smashing looms during the Industrial Revolution because he said the looms are displacing workers. And so I'm not a Luddite. I believe in technology. I'm using it right now. Obviously, we're all using it because we're all looking at this. It's done a tremendous amount of good for us. There are some challenges. And the challenge is the rate of change, not the actual change, okay? We've always had tremendous change. Over the last 100 years, we've gone agricultural workers from roughly 95% of the U.S. population to 3% of the U.S. population, and we produce more food today than we did 100 years ago. Yeah. So technology, done right, works fabulously. The problem is we are in a new paradigm. It's the rate of change, and it's these three things primarily: automation, robotics, and artificial intelligence. And they are coming on so quickly that we are having problems responding to them. McKinsey, I'm sorry, I'm my fault probably. McKinsey put out a report. Gotcha, okay. Do I point this at anywhere or a... good, okay. Oh, thank you. Yeah, this really works. All right. So McKinsey, at the end of last year, put out this report, and this is the actual title: Jobs Lost, Gained, Workforce Transition, etc. And what they said is 30% of the global workforce will be replaced or replaceable. 30%. This is absolutely unprecedented in the history of humanity. Okay? Ladies and gentlemen, it is approximately 2020 today. It's towards the end of 2018. We're talking just over 11 years from now. This is unbelievable, okay? And the problem is that 50% of those thrown out of work, their whole work style, what it is that they're doing, doesn't exist anymore for human beings. Okay? This is our world today. This is what we're coming into. Okay, and then of course the those of us who are older, we get thrown out of work first, and then we have greater trouble learning with what it is that we're doing. Here's some quotes from the Fed, and it says the same thing. Says, "Man, this is not working." These are U.S. You can look at them later. I'll show you. And I'm told that I'm running out of time. That's why I'm really speeding up. I'm not going to spend a bunch of time on this. It's kind of interesting. And this is the 8th District. This is St. Louis. but St. Louis Fed that put this out, but they said basically this is the same for the whole country. And if you, this is the worst. So this is the most number of people that are most likely to be replaced. So if you are in this circle, and that's office and administrative support. I just, you know. not easy. What are we going to do about this? So jobs, again, what do we get? So there's the prayer aspect, there's the community action council aspect, there's the policy aspect, there's the education aspect. These are all things that we can speak into, that we can pray into, that we can be a part of what this is all about. Let's look at demographics. This is a teaching slide. So you don't, I really don't want, so I just want to show you, these are a demographic or population pyramids are what they're called. And they're a picture, and pictures are really, really helpful. In one picture, you can get an instant analysis. Let me show you. So that is a rapidly expanding population. So here's an example, Angola, for instance, okay? So it's this pyramid. This down here are babies. Every single one of these are 5 years, okay, approximately. And these down here are the babies. So you notice, whoa, we got an enormous number of babies, and they're all going to grow up, and they're going to become humans, and some of them will die, obviously. And so the pyramid, the top, you know, nobody gets to be older than 130. I think we've got up to 124 now or something, the oldest human being that was alive. So this is expanding, this is stationary, and this is contracting. You notice that the number of babies that are born are less than the population. So in one picture, you get a pretty well instant overview as to where are we at. What the, you're from Brazil, you're from Ecuador, you're from the United States. Show me the pyramid, and I'll show you what's happening in your culture. I mean, it's really that simple. It's a wonderful picture. So here are two examples. One is Angola, one is Japan. You can see that Japan has a massive problem. So we've got post-war. These are the baby boomers, a lot of babies. And then the babies had babies. And then the babies' babies had babies. And you notice each one is smaller. And now we're all the way down here. We don't have any babies anymore. We got a problem. All right. This is us. this is the baby boomers. Then the babies had babies. And then nobody had babies, you know, by and large. So these are issues that we need to deal with. What in the world does that mean? Okay, that has implications all over the map. And I just said, okay, I'm going to take one aspect. I don't have time to go through all this. So I did this chart. I just went online and picked out data that I found. And this is the number of workers per Social Security recipients. How many people actually working, making a salary, are putting money into the Social Security system? By the way, there's no such thing as a security lockbox. Anybody who talks, either is really ignorant or is an out-and-out liar. Those are the only two options. And I'm not sure which of those two are better. But that's kind of, okay, no lockbox. No existe, okay? So just want to make sure, because I know you all know who I'm talking about. All right, well, this is a bit of a crash here, okay? However, this is kind of hard to read, so I thought, oh, let's make this a little bit easier. So this is exactly the same chart, the previous one. I just pulled it out here. I just wanted to show you what's happening down here. And you notice it's not getting any better. Now, by the way, this number, I believe, is 2.8, if I remember correctly. So we have 2.8 workers per Social Security recipient. If the Social Security recipient were to get the same salary as the average worker, which they don't, but there's some kind of a similarity, just under 40% of your total income would just go to this. Yeah. And you have not paid any taxes, and you have not... nothing else. And you've already gone through 40% of your money. Really? And this is sustainable? Let me give you a very deep esoteric statement. What is not sustainable will stop. I know that's kind of hard to get, but... Slow down. This is a football, you know, that's right. All right. You guys. The jobs. You know, let me explain you the difference between a recession and a depression. It goes like this, really, really very simple. Are you ready? This is just as simple as the last statement. A recession is when you lose your job. A depression is when I lose my job. I know, that's deep economics. Okay? If we don't have answers for this, if we don't work for this, we're going to see hell break loose on earth. I believe we do have answers. Oh, boy. Okay. I'm going to have to go quickly. So, Thucydides. Who in the world is he? Thucydides is the author of the definitive account of the history of the Peloponnesian War. That was the war between Greece and between Athens and Sparta. What was interesting, it was brought up earlier. And what was also interesting is I had this in my slide deck already. It was incorporated in there. And then I went to an event of top economists and stuff. And one of the guys had put a whole package together on Thucydides' trap. And I'm going, you got to be kidding! I've got it in my presentation here. So I came home to my wife, to Carol, and I said, "You'll never believe." She goes, "You're kidding me." I go, "No." She says, "Well, he did all the work for you, so you know." I thought, oh, this is really great. This is a big deal. So I listed this as one of my top four problems. Well, what is it? Okay, the term Thucydides' trap comes from a book just put out by Graham Allison. If you wanna read it down there, it's called. Let me not give you the title. I didn't want to do that. The trap is a situation under which a current hegemon, good Lord, what's that word mean? I'll tell you right away. Feels threatened by a potential future hegemon. Hegemon is simply the top of the pile. It's we all play games. Who's the king? Sorry. There you go, king of the mountain. Thank you. Well, the king of the mountain is the hegemon. It's the person. It's the group. It's the country. That's king of the pile. And who's us? That's us as the U.S. Both economically and militarily, we are the hegemon, and we are afraid that China is coming up as a new hegemon. And the Thucydides trap is that is exactly what happened 3,000 years ago, and we can learn by analysis to what's this all about. All right. So. Actions on both sides are always economic and often military. And this is going to drive our world for the next 15, 20 years. And you need to watch this, okay? This is happening. It's the result of asymmetric information. That means the both sides don't know what the other side's doing. Okay, and so we've got spycraft, we've got decision, we've got deception, we got blah, all sorts of things. But the Americans don't know what the Chinese are really going to do, and the Chinese don't know what the Americans are going to do. Okay, so from a military perspective, we have freedom. What do you call it? Naval? Where the U.S. the U.S. Navy insists on keeping on going through the South China Sea. Freedom of. Come on, what's it called? There's a word for why they do that. Anyway, it doesn't matter. That's the military side of it. Actions are based on fear, national interest, and seeking honor. Does that sound familiar? Okay. So the fundamentals of why we make decisions are based on what we think they will do because we're afraid of them. And we have these two behemoths that are trampling while the little, those of us who are mice down there, we get trampled by the elephant's feet, okay? By the way, of the 16 historical examples Allison gives us in his book, 12 of them ended in war. May it not be. All right? So economically, what does that mean today? Well, the problem is both she and Trump go around saying, we're going to make our country great again. By the way, exactly the same line from both leaders. This is the trap that we are in. Okay, we've got the World Bank versus the AIIB, the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank. We've got the IMF, because the AIIB is really doing both. So China is setting up a complementary system, okay, that it not only opposes, but it's there because of this whole thing of fear, national interest, and honor, all right? What's our response? Well... It's more to do with prayer and analysis, especially education. If we can educate people, let me explain to you why these choices are being made. Are they rational? Not necessarily, but they're rational within the trap situation. Okay? How's that for a quote? It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. It was a season of light, and it was a season of darkness. And that's what we're in. I'm an optimist because I believe that God and we have answers, that we have power, that we have faith, that we can keep on moving. Okay? Ladies and gentlemen, every challenge is an opportunity for those who are poor in spirit. All right? This is one of my most favorite verses in the Bible. Daniel 11:32, those who know their God will display strength and take action. Just very simply, what am I doing? I'm not suggesting that you do what I do, but I'm suggesting that you do what God is calling you to do. And just very quickly, I don't have any time, and I really don't want to spend a bunch of time on this. So a number of us have set up the Monetary Institute, trying to look at one part of this issue, the monetary side, which has all sorts of implications, and how do we do that from the point of view of credibility, of research, of an aggregation of material that is out there, of conferences, etc. Okay? So the point is to drive monetary and fiscal strategies that better serve and protect humanity. We seek to effect fundamental structural changes to national monetary systems worldwide that end the nearly universal practice of debt-based money creation by private banks as the primary source of money creation. What that simply means, those of you who haven't heard me before, is essentially 100% of our money is created through debt. If we had no debt, the dollars in your pockets would not exist. Simple as that. Okay. And by the way, the Swiss change was to stop that. There will be no more money created through debt, period. 100% of the money, instead of debt-based, it will be asset-based. Okay. What are we doing? And these are only, I've got a huge long slide deck on this, but I just pulled up. So media, newspapers, conferences, etc. What is that we're doing on this area? And that's really the point. What's your birthright? What's your call to action? I've just picked a few points. That's all. Just linking economics and politics and the kingdom. But what are you called to? And that's really the purpose of statesmen. And we have these four focus groups in order to help you to funnel the gifts that God has given you, the structures that you live in, the countries that you live in, the politics that you live under, the economics that all of us are subjected to. These are forces that we need to understand and need to deal with. Let me end with and this is not original either, and I can't come up with the name of the person right now. I do have it written down over there. So these little pictures, they really help. So these two fish, two young fish are swimming along. And as they're swimming along, this older fish comes by, and he's swimming in the opposite direction. And the older fish says to them, "Hey, boys, how's the water?" And the two fish keep on swimming along. And finally, one of them turns to the other and says, "What in the world is water?" That's really the point of what I want to say. How to learn, how to understand, and how to act in that. Bless you.